Lead UX, the User Experience Leadership Circle, hosted by Dr. Thomas Führinger-Kuhnt.
My UX background is what sets me for success in the PM role, because we designers, we have already so many skills. So first of all, empathy, the big king of UX field. The PMs, they are responsible for user requirements and extracting what users need. Designers, we're also responsible for this, right? What also is a huge advantage is the fact that we as designers, we're always actually convincing people. We're defending our design, we're arguing for it. And so we have those strong negotiation skills. At least as we mature and become more senior, this is a prerequisite for success for designers. And this is absolutely transferable for PM.
This podcast is sponsored by Horizons 2026, the User Experience Leadership Intensive. Inspire, lead, innovate. At Horizons, we are dedicated to developing leaders in the field of user experience design through transformative retreats and coaching programs. Use our methods and tools to expand your sphere of influence so that you can grow in your role and have a positive impact on your team, your organization, and your professional success. Find out more about our modules at www.horizons.community and check for suitable dates and venues. Seats are deliberately limited to ensure a confidential atmosphere and a safe space for open and practical discussion with other leaders. So book your ticket today.
Welcome to another episode of Lead UX, the User Experience Leadership Circle, your compass through the ever-evolving landscape of UX leadership and the challenges and opportunities in our profession. My guest today is Diana Belodedov, who is product owner at Volkswagen Group IT and community lead of Design Horizontal. And we met at UX Camp, where she gave a great talk about her career path, and I thought it might be a great opportunity to talk about that in a bit more detail here on the show. So great to have you here, Diana.
Thank you, Thomas. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, my pleasure. This episode, as I said, is about Diana's path from UX into product management, but also about identity, maybe career shifts and changes, and the moments when a career shift becomes more than just a role change. So this is going to be a really interesting topic for all our listeners who may be currently a bit struggling with their UX future career topics and things like that. So very much looking forward to hear more about your background and your thought process behind this career way. So, but before we dive into the details, I always like that the listeners get to know you a bit better. So to start simply, the question I always ask in the beginning, what gets you up in the morning these days from a professional point of view?
From a professional point of view? Well, the sun gets me up in the morning nowadays because it's very rare in Berlin. So that's that on a personal note. But I think professionally, it's really building the right thing and building the right product. And this is my motivation. It sounds very cheesy. It sounds very designerish and very product, but it is that. I love interacting with people. And so, you know, waking up in the morning, I'm already kind of excited and curious about the new interactions, especially now where I build a product that is not live yet. And we're in a lot of discovery phases. I think this is the most exciting part for me. Kind of how can we take, you know, the challenges that people have, all of that complexity that comes in the enterprise environment and consolidate it to, you know, as simple as possible of a solution. Yeah.
Yeah. Great, great. So the motivation you shared, I mean, I heard quite some time already, but I think every professional path is individual. So can you walk us a little bit about your or get us a glimpse about your professional path. So where did it start, and what were the career changes that we will talk about in a bit more detail throughout this talk?
Sure. So I would say I have like a very traditional design path, but also pretty fluid in the roles that I took throughout the years. And I need to thank a lot to my university, because I think it really established a very solid fundament when it comes to my interests and also skills. So I studied product design. Back in the days, product design actually meant physical product design. So we're designing, you know, everything from chairs, but also devices and things like this. And while at it, I also took a lot of interaction design courses, which kind of really opened my eyes to how the physical, but also the digital worlds are connected within products and also, of course, environments, and how we can create experiences throughout different touch points in that case. And so I think it set me up to a good route. I then worked in different roles, like service design, like designing a education program for architects and designers. So kind of looking again, what are the touch points of a course, of an education course? Then I also worked with different startups, like Mello was one of them, was a really exciting one. It was a platform for connecting parent experts within Germany and kind of making friends through these two pillars. And, you know, how fragile of an experience that could be, and, you know, how do we bring people together was really interesting. And then fast forward, I work in Volkswagen. I was hired as a digital product designer, you know, so kind of like the end-to-end designer with full ownership. This is, I think, what is not super unique, but unique in that sense, that we really are responsible usually for one product from discovery till delivery and also maintenance of that product. And yeah, then I worked on different products. So maybe interesting for the audience would also be to kind of like place me in their head, what I do and where I work. So currently I work in Volkswagen Group IT, which is the IT sector of the entire Volkswagen group. And I work in the development center, or like software development center, which means that we are the co-partner for any business department that needs a product either developed or also transformed. So transition from, let's say, mainframe to cloud. So we have a lot of brownfield, so to say, products, as well as greenfield products too. Yeah, and this is why it's so exciting, because it's kind of the back office of Volkswagen operations, right? There is the customer-facing role where you can, you know, how do you interact with the car, what services you have, what options do you have, you know, on the app to open the car or, you know, get a service, a repair at the shop. What we do is more, how can we enable the people that work within the organization to, yeah, basically have a more delightful work, but also more efficient, and how we can make the processes better. So for instance, if we have a brownfield product, that would also mean it's not only opportunity for what we call lift and shift, but also really this is the point where we stop and ask, okay, what are the processes? Why are they the way they are? And how we can make the new application better and better suitable for the people that work now and not maybe 30 years ago. And yeah, for it to be, yeah, how do you say? Zeitgemäß. Some words I only know in German. You know, yeah. When you studied in Germany, that's kind of a thing. Yeah.
Yeah, great. So yeah. Your customers are the internal Volkswagen employees then in the end, not the end customers who buy the vehicle.
Exactly. Yeah. And then just to add on that, because I mean, now we're talking about my role as product manager or product owner. So yeah, I worked on different products throughout the years, really from sales, then to compliance. And also I had the opportunity to lead a design team in one of them. And fast forward nowadays, I would call it I'm still in the transition into my new role because I still do some design tasks on my day to day. But yeah, role is product manager or product owner in safe environment. For those who don't know what safe is scaled agile framework.
Yeah, great. So you mentioned processes already. So I think this is something that you were into in that role, especially from the very beginning. Also, mm-hmm. when you were like a real designer. and so when did you notice that you actually are interested in those processes topics and also maybe the product decisions and even the business goals probably that might be behind that?
I would say always.
Mm-hmm.
From the very start. I think because early on in my career, I had the opportunity to work really close to a CEO, for instance. And I was always asking those questions. I needed to basically answer those questions, like, you know, how do we make money? How do we know that it's good? How do we know that people actually need it and want it? And so when I worked on products, I was always kind of the annoying designer, so to say, who would ask, you know, why are we building this? Like, why is this important? Because also the way we work is that we have a lot of products and sometimes we're lucky enough to choose which product we can be allocated to. And so from that lens, I would always look at this. If it's a green product, sometimes it's very experimental and it has a lot of potential. But maybe you have less exposure to users and so also less impact. Or if it's a very huge system and it's a modernization, it's kind of a pillar system for the company, for their operations, then you know, okay, this maybe it's a little bit more boring because, you know, a lot of things are decided, but it has a lot of impact on the bigger scale of the company. And so, yeah, I was the person who always would also bother my PMs. As like, wait, but who actually decided this? And like, which user gave this feedback? Let's go and talk to them and understand a little bit more. So I think this is what set me up also for my curiosity for the PM role, because, you know, as a designer, you always say, I want to sit at the table, or like a lot of us do. And you want to get closer to that. And that was also my goal. How can I get closer? It's not about role or title, but more of the ownership and exposure to the bigger picture.
Yeah, that's great. But I think it takes two things to be able to actually speak up and ask those questions. I mean, at first hand, you have to be brave enough, even as a young designer, to actually ask those questions. But on the other hand, it seems like in your group, there is this environment where those questions are also valued. And as you said, even C-level executives would then come to you and ask those questions or give you the answers that you asked for. So yeah, this is an important topic also about company culture, I think.
Yeah, but I think even as a junior, you know, it's about getting the information. It doesn't matter where you get the information from. So when I was firstly hired in Volkswagen, we also back in the days did a lot of design pairing. So we would design, like co-design together, kind of like pair programming and pair designing. And so, you know, we get an assignment, there is this story or this feature that needs to be designed or a part of a flow. I could still ask the designer and there will be like, wait, I also don't know. And then it triggers them to go and ask, right? So at some point the information would come, but I think it's all about being that curious person that, I mean, I think it's maybe also like a personality trait in a sense, because I'm the kind of person that likes when I know what I work towards, because this gives me motivation. this fuels my kind of inner spark.
Yes, and of course, we can encourage everybody, despite personality traits, to actually ask those questions. Why are we building this? Just in the next episode, we will have an own topic just talking about those early stages in product development, where you can also do some research and to get a better understanding if the product you're building is actually something which would solve users' problems. So that's super important, and I definitely would encourage everybody in the design field to simply ask those questions. And I guess so you observed in something in the PMs you worked with that somehow felt interesting or natural or attractive to you, because actually at some point in your career, obviously you decided also to move into that direction. So what did attract you to that role, or what were the topics that the PMs were doing to make this attractive?
At the beginning, I just focus on my design domain, right? I love designing. I'm more of a UXer rather than a UIer, if you want to put me on some kind of scale in your head. And at some point, I started observing PMs, and I was really fascinated by basically their orchestration skills, how they can multitask and like jump between different environments, like almost like chameleons, kind of changing. You know, you need to change yourself to the situation. So sometimes they're more of a defender, defending the team, so they have more time to work on something. Then in a different case, they're more of a orchestrator. It's about how can we have a dynamic and fruitful conversation. Then they also have the head of the strategic thinker, you know, the things long term, how do we get there? But then also they make decisions really quick, sometimes without knowing all of the story, right? But why? Yeah, like it's a never ending conversation if you keep asking, but we need to make a decision now. And I think all of those characteristics I was both curious about, but also I felt like I resonate with a lot of it. And this is where I started kind of looking more behind the shoulder of my product managers that I was working with. And slowly but surely, to be honest, my transition was more of a lucky coincidence, so to say, or like very dynamic, very natural. So for me, it happened in the way that my PM, she was anyhow very busy. So we were working on this AI product, which was pretty big in the terms of like how many people and complexity and so on. She had a lot on her shoulders. And I, in the same time, was very curious about her work and about also all of those aspects that I said before, right? Like, why are we building this? And like, let's try and measure things with UX and with the data that we have. And she saw it, and she kind of invited me to slowly and surely help her. So of course, in the beginning, it was more, okay, we have the design ready, we review it, and then we write stories, so I can take over some of the design story writing, which anyhow makes sense. I think nowadays it's a standard anyway to just kind of collaborate on this, right? And then later on, when she would go on vacations, I think this is where the aha moment really happened, because all of a sudden I'm there. I mean, not alone, but in that sense, alone representing the team. So we were several teams working also with external agencies, and there was a lot of eyes on this project. So, you know, a lot of management is sitting in the room when things like, you know, roadmaps are discussed and so forth. And I need to explain everyone, you know, what did we deliver, maybe what we did not, what kind of hiccups we have, what kind of challenges we have. It was really intimidating, but also very interesting because all of a sudden you're exposed to broader circles of influence. And I think the most challenging in those moments is to not have someone to hide behind. Yeah.
Yeah, so for me, there are two things to take away. So if there are opportunities, you have to take it. So as you did, there were an opportunity to try out something new or step into a kind of a new role and then, yeah, do it. And also you described you stepped a bit out of your comfort zone as well. Is this a summary which would you agree to?
Absolutely. And I think a prerequisite for that was also that we were two designers on the team. So I'm super thankful also for the other designer that I worked with, who absolutely understood the situation and also gave me the room to kind of be the both, the symbiotic creature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the title of your talk was Oops, I Became a PM. So this sounded like you woke up next morning and boof, there you were. But it sounds like it was a bit of a, let's say, also more time-consuming transition or process. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's definitely a build-up, right? That was just what I said before about the transition, like covering up for a PM. She still stayed the PM and I still stayed the designer at that product, but it gave me the taste. It was just the first kind of key to the first door, just to like, or like maybe it was me peeking in through the lock and seeing what's on the other side and tasting. But I think I also hit a wall with that, because once I started thinking about, okay, so maybe PMing is something for me, and I already kind of like was trying the clothes of a PM and the tasks, I realized that that might be a betrayal to design and to the designer that I am, because I feel where designers are so, there is something very unique about designers, and I also observe it in our organization. We're usually the smaller group, but we're very, very united. We like people, we like exchanging with people, we like sticking together, we like exchanging ideas. We also like to stand our ground, and we were taught that what we do is very important, and it is. And so I always feel like designers, they have this shield. They're like the warriors of the product development process. And so I didn't want to lose that. I felt that that would be, yeah, as I said, a betrayal, like I would do something wrong. It's like a sin, and I would lose things. This was kind of my imposter syndrome or like self-talk that I had. What would happen? I think with every transition, you have this process where you're like hitting a wall in terms of fear. You know, fear is kicking in and you're like, wait. Let's think about it. Not so fast. So yeah, I hit a wall there for quite a while. And so as a solution for that, part of me said, let's try, like we can take it to the next step. And I think, again, this is a very luxurious situation where I need to really, really thank my managers and the environment that I'm in that allowed that. And that is to say, so I talked with my managers and we said, okay, what if in the next product, I will take an official PO role, but I would pair with another PM. So I would split the role, so to say. And this is where I am at the moment. So our product now, it is a modernization product and I'm pairing with another PM. He's very technical and has PMing experience. I'm very UX-erish and still learning. Yeah, this is where I am. But I think, yeah, I also talked about it in my talk that I had this aha moment where I saw a talk. I think it was in the UXDX from Tim Rost, I believe his name. And he said something like, he has this quote, like I quoted it, being the sheep in the wolf clothes. Because in throughout his career, he said that, so he's a designer, right? And at some point he realized that he wants to do more with his design skills. And so he started transitioning to unconventional roles for a designer, experience lead, stuff like this. And he could really influence the business from within while promoting UX. And it could really resonate with it, right? Like, because in the end of the day, this is what we designers want, right? Any organization can benefit from UX maturity increase. Any organization can benefit from more design leadership, right? What we talk about, designer at the table, at the decision table. And so once I switched this thinking into this thinking of, oh, it's not about the role, because I would always be a designer. This is what I believe, right? Like, you're a designer for once and for all. And once I understood this, I think this fear, or a lot of it, just naturally calmed down, because the mission all of a sudden became much stronger than the fear.
Yeah, but can we go back for a moment to this emotional barrier? Because this is really an interesting point, which also struck me during your talk. So why did you think it was a betrayal? Because actually you were now in the position to decide things. Why was it a betrayal, or why did you have bad conscience about, you know, this role shift?
I think as designers, we take a lot on ourselves. And I think this is part of it, the designer pride, I call it. And it takes some time to also loosen up throughout your career and understand that, yeah, like, you're not so important. Yeah, you have the methodology. And yes, you're so empathic. But in the end of the day, everyone in the organization have their impact. But still, I think it's more that I thought that I will lose something. It was a betrayal to design. Like, for example, we're three colleagues leading the design horizontal community. So that was an insecurity of mine. Does it mean that I cannot play with the cool kids anymore if I go and become a product manager, right? Does it mean that I'm seen differently? I'm seen maybe by my managers differently. All of a sudden, yeah, I'm just in a different group. And I think that was a lot of the insecurity that I felt that could be relieved by the fact that I'm just, as a person, you're never defined by your role. Yeah, it's your job, right? 8 hours, or, you know, give and take, going into this every day, but still, you're a human being, and you can be a T shape, and you can also be a P shape, right? I feel like I'm now a P shape, so I have the design. Maybe it's a longer P, and the PM, and all the other skills orchestrated somewhere above.
Yeah, that's definitely understandable. So, and you mentioned that you were also very much supported by your own managers, and then who saw your ambitions and supported you. By the way, did those fears come true, that you were not, or that we were seen differently by the designers? Maybe let's talk about that at first. So did they really see you differently, or was this just a fear you had in the beginning, which never luckily it came true?
I think most of the designers that I spoke with actually said it makes total sense. Like, it was not unexpected. Yeah, because they know I'm the curious person that kind of like somewhere between UX and PM from the get-go. So I was never too very much interested in like stuff like design systems and the nitty gritty of the pixel perfect, And I super appreciate the craft, and I love working with talented people that can go and dig so deep, and, you know, they have just talented minds. But I was never too interested in that. So I anyhow played in the field of the intersection of the roles. Yeah. And people around me, I think they're pretty much encouraging. Yeah. And I can still play with the cool kids. Like I still join all the design rituals yeah, and, yeah. you know, we still drink coffee as usual.
Great. Yeah. So, yeah, as you said, the recognition from outside was super important. So, this was also something about, I think, company culture, as I said, and also leadership, which, yeah, you have to be lucky enough to work in such an environment. So maybe you can talk a little bit about this external support that actually then, as I understood, marked a turning point for you to finally decide to officially step into that role.
Totally. So I think a lot of pillars or like a lot of points actually fueled into this transition and me gaining the confidence. It even started before me thinking about the transition with formats like, for instance, in Volkswagen, we have some internal mentoring programs. So I was mentored by another leader and she gave me so much confidence. So I would meet monthly with her. And first, I would get a little bit more exposure as to kind of like, you know, the dynamics of the company. And then she would also give me tasks, like tasks of me going outside of my comfort zone. So it already kind of loosened up my sensitivity to, you know, going to certain rooms or raising my voice or, yeah, taking the extra step. Then my manager is super encouraging and, you know, with what he can offer, he would always support and help, and make sure that I'm, you know, I'm growing. I can take courses. Yeah, different conferences and so forth, which is also something that I would always encourage people to do, right? Like step out of your bubble, because a company can very much be a bubble. See what other companies are doing, what is happening in the industry, because this is part of it, right? To recognize that also with AI, you know, things will change, roles will change, and they are changing already. Yeah, and actually when I joined, I also had a really nice mentor. He was a designer, but I think he also gave me a lot of confidence. Also, you know, you just came in and he's like, okay, who is who? What is what? How things work here? And I think part of the culture within our organization, so specifically my department, because we're product designers or digital product designers, part of the skills that they were searching for when hiring is this ownership. And this is something that we always try to, you know, build more and more of. Because oftentimes you're the only designer for the entire product. So you're responsible for the discovery, you know, for the design itself, and also for building up from MVP then to a more mature product. So of course you need more skills than maybe when you're a huge team of designers and everyone is doing their small part. So I think those are all really fueled to this point where I could say, okay, I feel confident and I feel that I can rely on the environment, and worst case scenario, I can always, you know, say it's too much and maybe I can roll back.
Yeah, that's great. So maybe we can have a bit a closer look on the relationships to the different people you worked with. So I assume when you stepped into this new role and talked to your fellow designers, they were maybe, it was easier maybe for them to understand the boundaries and decisions that need to be done by a PM. But how was it with other, like more technical people? So did they also recognize you as somebody who has a say, or were they looking differently at you because you came from a design area? So how was this interdisciplinary collaboration working?
That's a good question. So some of the people in my current team, I work with them before already. So I think this also a big contributor to the trust. And I think it's pretty rare that our designers are moving to PMs. I know other companies, they just have it as part of the growth path. For us, it's not that common to see that. I think it was more of a personal path because on the one hand, I have now my pair PM who's very, very technical and like very professional and good in what he is doing. So I can learn a lot from him. So, you know, I can still have someone that I can lean on. And on the other side, I have the confidence of my teammates because some of them I worked with, so they kind of give me more room. And also my curiosity, right? So I think there are no stupid questions. And while I'm still growing into the role, I feel confident asking them, be it asking them directly to the developers or to Chat or Claude, which is also legit. You know, we have a pre-IPM, like sprint planning, and I'm still chatting with the chat sometimes on the side just to understand a little bit on the go what the developers mean. And I think this is a big thing. So I would encourage anyone, even, you know, if you're even a junior designer, to interact more with developers and try to understand their main concepts, right? Like what is architecture? What is CI/CD? What are those pillar terms? What do they mean? What does it mean push to production? And how much time things take, and maybe pairing with a dev to really see, you know, how they work. And so I think this is really sets you up for success to show that you're curious and not just, because you could also just say, write whatever devs are saying that needs to be done. Or on the contrary, you can just tell the devs what they need to do without having the discussion. So I think it's really creating this trust dynamic within the team that allows a conversation. And as I said, yeah, I think this is part of this psychological safety bars, right? If you're confident that you can ask stupid questions and maybe appear a little bit dumb from time to time.
Or maybe ask Claude. Yes, that's definitely also a good idea.
Absolutely.
Yeah, to get a certain level of technical understanding on the side. Yes. So from a day-to-day work, so I guess it for sure changed. So how your days look nowadays compared to a couple of years ago. So if now our listeners are considering, okay, maybe this might be a path for me as well, because I'm unsecure about how design develops with all the AI support that might make my work superfluous or something like that. So how did your daily work change actually? What's now your typical day looking like compared to a couple of years ago?
Yeah. So I must admit that I still do a little bit of design work in our team because currently we don't have a designer in the team. We'll get one soon. So that would also be a learning, right? Like how the dynamic works now that I'm the PM and working with a designer. I would start maybe in a different point. So not only how the day changed, but also what are the trade-offs? I think you gain a lot of aspects like, yeah, okay, you have more say maybe in the product. You can think more strategically, you gain confidence, you gain some negotiation skills, right? But you also lose stuff because obviously there are only 24 hours in the day and only maybe 8 or, you know, whatever you have in a working day. So you cannot pack it all in. So things like the perfect Figma design is a trade-off. The small details of how everything should work is a trade-off. You're not on this level anymore because you're more on the level of, okay, what is the roadmap for the year? What is the roadmap for next quarter? What are the most important features that need to be delivered for the users to be happy? I mean, we have the challenge with modernization software, for instance, that imagine you have a software for 30 years and users are used to that. And sometimes the software needs to be modernized, not because the users want the software to be modernized, but just because IT needs to, you know, modernize itself. And so oftentimes in such projects, we have the challenge that we work with MVPs, but the MVPs, they're not suffying the user need. And so we need to work really strategically to gain the user trust. They don't have all the functionalities in the system yet, while still, you know, working slowly but surely towards the bigger picture. So in terms of the days, I would say I spend less time on the hands-on work, definitely. I still do that. And I think AI is a big companion nowadays, because especially now with Figma releasing the Figma agent and what happens with Claude Design and GitHub Copilot and all of this, it's so much easier to also work on this boundary between the roles. So I'd said a little bit more on the roadmap, a little bit more on the backlog, making sure that the developers know what to build and making it very, very coherent for them, which is also something to learn, because I think this is something that was also a little bit influenced by me, but also by the fact that we're now going a little bit more into agentic development, is that sometimes the stories are, they need more technical understanding, which is something that then really encourages me to move towards the technical part of things. So it means that I need to understand the business partners much, much better than before. Because before I could just say, okay, there is FRD, so a feature requirement document or some kind of a documentation of requirements, and I can just work with that. Now I need to be sure that I'm the person in the room that understands a lot of the business knowledge, or at least can act as a reliable partner if the team doesn't have the comprehension. Our developers are really motivated in understanding the user aspect. This is kind of part of the mindset that everyone is trying to understand the big picture. And so it makes my role pretty challenging in this case, because I need to really provide the information and make sure that they have it documented coherently. Also, again, a big thank you for the AI that allows things like documentation being much easier done than before. Yeah. And of course, a lot of meetings.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a culture thing. I think it's something that maybe will go a little bit lower in the future because of AI and asynchronous communication. But nowadays, it's still a lot of communication in many, many levels. And I think this is a big skill for PMs. What I said before, it's a little bit this chameleon, this hat, different hat wearing that a PM needs to have. How do you communicate with the team? How do you communicate with the department? How do you communicate with the stakeholders? How do you negotiate and have maybe sometimes difficult conversations? Because you need to protect the team or the team's motivation, or vice versa. Maybe you need to tell the team that we could do stuff better next time.
So your background in UX, was it an advantage? So could you use some of your knowledge in terms of, yeah, being empathic with the users, also being empathic with now the developers, maybe. So was this an advantage for you that you had this background in UX for this role?
Absolutely. I think my UX background is what sets me for success in the PM role, because we designers, we have already so many skills that are applicable, right? So first of all, empathy, the big king of UX field. We're empathic. And I think one thing that I was kind of an aha moment for me when I started in this transition to PM was the fact that I understood that, well, actually, in a lot of the literature and kind of the job description, we see that there is a big overlap. So the PMs, they are responsible for user requirements, empathy, and extracting what users need. Designers, on the other hand, we're also responsible for this, right? So this is from the get-go. If you have the empathy and if you have the methodology to extract those insights, then it also makes you immediately a better PM because you understand what users really need and where they're coming from, and you can develop better things. I think what also is a huge advantage is the fact that we as designers were always actually convincing people. We're defending our design, we're arguing for it, and so we have those strong negotiation skills. At least as we mature and become more senior, this is a prerequisite for success for designers, and this is absolutely transferable for PM because, yeah, negotiation is the, how you say in German, A und O, kind of like the very basic thing that, because most of your day is meetings and a lot of, you know, communication with others. Yeah, I think those are the main strengths. I also can see it. I told you before, I work with this PM who's a little bit more on the technical side, and even the quality of questions that we ask when interacting with stakeholders are completely different. This is why we really, yeah, complete one another.
Let's do a little thought experiment. I was just thinking maybe it should be a part of the education for every designer to do at least partly some PM work. So now if you would go back to the work as a design team lead, what would be different, or would you be a better design team lead now with that experience in as a product owner maybe?
Yes, I think one thing that is not necessarily a lesson from the PM role, but more of a from the design and failures in the design role is stakeholder management, in the sense of having empathy to everyone, towards all the stakeholders and all the people involved in a project. I think one core learning, and I think this goes both for PMs and designers, is having some time to talk with each individual in the team, or maybe the most important, you know, parts of the groups that represent them. Because oftentimes, first of all, the personal level, the personal connection is always what counts in further collaboration. But then also understanding where people come from. So what are the priorities of the stakeholder? And I think this is what PMs or good PMs are really good at, is really understanding what are the priorities of each individual or each and every group, and trying to cater in the best way possible to all of those. I don't know if simultaneously, in the best way they can, though. Yeah, I think this is one thing, because even from a design experience, I had so many experiences where people had expectations, but they were not talking the same language and they didn't have the same goals, and a lot of frustration starts bubbling in those moments. So I think this is definitely that, and yeah, asking the annoying questions. This is really the pillar, because for being a better designer, you need to know the bigger context. You need to know what the vision of this project is. You also need to absolutely know what the financial situation of the project is. So why did the company decide to build this product or this feature? How does it contribute either to the reduction of cost or to the acquisition of more for the company? So if you understand this and you can kind of build your, maybe not going to CEO and asking that directly, but kind of building it through a chain of connections and people, that would be super helpful, because then you can, of course, take the train back and argue in the same way to whatever decision or whatever argument you have at hand that you need to convince someone with.
Yeah, I think, yeah, especially when it comes to stakeholder management, it's super important. I mean, it's not about convincing somebody else of your point of view, but helping them to solve their problems, because in the end, everybody, of course, wants to have the best solution, but maybe from different viewpoints. And then, yeah, that's what, you know, what definitely needs a sort of mind shift and different point of view. If you want to convince somebody of something, then yes, you have to, in the end, help them to solve their problems and not convince them to, yeah, follow your understanding of the best solution and things like that. So, but coming to the financial situations and numbers, so was this something you were scared of, or maybe, or something which was unfamiliar? Because quite often, at least, it seems like designers are a bit afraid of dealing with numbers and maybe Excel sheets and things like that. So how was that experience for you?
Well, luckily, I don't need to deal too much with Excel spreadsheets nowadays.
Yeah.
But I must say that I was already curious about that even in my design practice. So, for instance, I can only recommend I took the MBA course back in the days, which is business for designers. Like it's not a real MBA, but it kind of takes the essence of a lot of the concepts of business and fuels them into how design practice can benefit from it. So I found this was super beneficial. And also, I don't think it's scary because we have AI. And so it's easier than ever to, you know, put some information, whatever you can compliantly put in the systems that you can compliantly use, and ask questions on it, right? Like, how can we measure this and that in a coherent way? How can I, you know, make the best in the time that we have with the resources, like in terms of, you know, capacity. Capacity management is also a huge topic for product management. So yeah, I didn't become a finance person because specifically in my department, it's not like I'm not responsible for each and every number on the sheet, but having the bigger concepts in mind, I think it's really beneficial. Yeah. So taking some courses on just success metrics and how they work, I think it's really good to have in the pocket.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great advice. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. No, because you asked before what I would recommend to designers. And I think it's really first getting out of your comfort zone also in the sense of what kind of information you're consuming, because I think this is where the curiosity also can spark beyond and can serve you not only for the PM transition or whatsoever, but also for the design practice. So I think Lenny's podcast is a huge, you know, it's a huge one. It's very, very known, but it's great because, of course, going to conferences, it's good, but you don't always have the opportunity. I think this is one of the podcasts where you can really get exposed to what is happening in the industry and how other professionals make decisions. And maybe this is also something that you can bring into your company, get inspired, you know, write someone of them on LinkedIn, ask for, I don't know, a question or even a mentoring session if you're absolutely brave.
Yeah, I mean, this was basically in the end also motivation to start this podcast here to give people like you a platform and share their experiences, because I think that's super valuable for others to learn from. And you
Absolutely.
mentioned already the mentoring, so I guess this is also something you would definitely recommend when you step out of the comfort zone. Better have somebody aside who can support you a little bit, right?
Yes. So I also recently started mentoring on ADP List, which I used for a long time as well. Yeah, by the way, I forgot to mention, this is also something that from time to time when I need a little bit of a either a confidence boost or just I have a specific question as to, how other people deal with it in other companies or just a piece of advice I would go to. So it's a platform that offers free mentorship. They started as a design platform, but I think now they expanded to other roles. So yeah, you're also welcome to set a session with me. I'm new to the platform, but it's really fun, and I think I learn a lot through mentoring as well. So it's really exciting.
Yeah, great. So we will definitely put a link into the show notes that people then can get in contact with you, and maybe others as well for mentoring and support during their potential career transitions. We touched briefly on AI, so maybe we can at the end have a bit of a closer look. Of course, I mean, this is a topic on its own, but you have a quite positive view on AI, I think. So as I understood, as something which supports you and helps you understanding things and not just steal your job. So but when it comes to automation, things like that, so a lot of people are a bit scared. Also, so what's your view on AI? How is AI changing the UX and designers' roles, and maybe also the PM roles? I don't know.
You said I'm positive. I would say, depending which day you ask me.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an emotional roller coaster. I think, like with every tool, with every new thing that you need to learn. Currently, I put a lot of energy in setting up different things, and there is a lot of frustration at first when, when things doesn't work the way you expect. I think it's very interesting how it changes the roles slowly but surely. And for a long time, I was kind of trying to dig into, oh, how it's going to change my role and like what it's going to mean to the future. And I had a pretty negative outlook when I found myself in those spiraling conversations with myself. And so what I decided to do is just cut that cable and say, let's see the opportunities and let's live at the now and see what are the best things that we can do with the situation at the moment, right? Live at the now, because I think those catatonic messages that sometimes appear on the internet, they're really discouraging. And so yeah, but I say things as they are because a lot of us are really scared and we already see some of the impact. But I think it's good to remember that just a general outlook that I have with AI is that some of us feel that we don't have control. But I think this is the most dangerous thing to think. Because we didn't decide a lot of those decisions that the big corporates decided for us. And so I think we can see it as an opportunity to say, okay, how we can leverage AI for building better things for people, practicing our job better. How can I have a chat with Claude about how can I negotiate with the stakeholder something that I believe that would be beneficial for the users because they just told me they absolutely need it, but there is maybe not budget right now, right? So how we can elevate those superpowers of ourselves. What we try to do now, and we're pretty successful, but we're still in the midst of our experiment, is to have a complete agentic orchestration of development. So the developers are pretty fast with that. And it also puts a lot of pressure on us PMs and designers, because of course they're working much faster now. And so everything that has to do with consolidation and gathering of requirements becomes, can become a bottleneck. And so this is where PMs and designers really need to have methods how to collect the information and structure it in a better way. So something that we just started experimenting with is like a grill me session by the end of a talk with a stakeholder, because oftentimes we have stakeholders that don't have so much time for us. And then we go to the team, we think, you know, we have the feature build, we have concepts, and then the developers ask a question or someone asks a question and we're like, wait, we actually don't know because it's not complete. And so this is why we want to have this more and more that we make our information more and more complete. Yeah. And of course, it enables me as a PM to do more prototyping, go more into the design, especially given the fact that we don't have a designer on the team. So of course, it's a privilege for me because I'm a designer, so I can do both. So it's definitely like a PM UX on steroids in a way.
Yeah, great. Yeah, so AI would be then more like a sparings partner, not something which takes away your job, but gives you even superpower to do your current job and your future job also even better.
I think it can be both ways, but we need to take responsibility. I think it's about that. It's what I said before about AI. I think we need to, sometimes not just surrender, but actively seek for opportunities to make the impact that we want a little bit stronger.
Yeah, so for everybody who feels threatened by AI, there is definitely hope.
Absolutely.
Yeah, great. Yeah, thanks, Diana, for sharing those super valuable insights. If now listeners think, okay, this might be something for me as well. So is there one thing from your story which you would, give them as a key takeaway message?
Yeah, I think ask questions. I mean, it's so obvious, I know, but sometimes we're afraid. Sometimes we don't want to give ourselves the uncomfortable feeling of being at the light where others can perceive us a little bit stupid or maybe unprepared. But I actually think that this is our superpower as designers, digging in, asking questions, and leveraging knowledge for our empowerment. So this is something that I would say. And if you are interested in maybe becoming a PM, or this is something that is interesting for you, try to find either a mentor or a coworker where you're like in good terms with, and have a conversation, maybe look behind their shoulder. Maybe ask them for feedback. What do they think? What kind of a PM you will be? And, you know, ask for honesty if you're, you know, if you're tough enough to bear it, and start from there. Start small.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. Great key takeaway message. And I think your journey clearly shows how professional identity can not shift, but evolve without losing your core values. And that was really great to have you on the show today and that you shared all your insights. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for inviting. Yeah, it was a delight, I hope.
Yeah, definitely. And as I said, we will add links to the topics you mentioned to the show notes so that our listeners can explore next steps. And yeah, thank you very much for being my guest today. Thank you very, very much, everyone who has listened and follow this podcast on the podcast platform of your choice, and talk to you soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.